give Toshi the bowl so that she can pick one number, and Donna from that bowl. Just pass that to take one number and let Donna take a number. Thanks. Good. Good. And John, you're going to be with this group during the break on the left side of the room. Toshi and Donna, you're going to be with the group on the right side, so just go with those people. They'll give you directions. Can you appreciate the Greek word for what you are considering now as a thesis, a point of view, an angle of vision? Can you appreciate that this angle of vision is strategically chosen to display the entire cross-section, the individual, the community, the largest form of the community, in our time, the planet, and the cosmos, and the very nature of reality itself? This particular diagonal, this particular cross-section, is strategically chosen to disclose all of these levels. But notice, it's only now in the art section that we are able to conceive of this in its full import. It's only at this stage that we have the capacity to appreciate literally what's at stake, to have a really good idea of what's happening. And all we need to do is just add one more element, one more idea to this, the idea of cyclicity in history. That every so often, every great period, it seems as if man comes back yet again, maybe with new capacities and new dimensions and new forms to deal with, but comes back to the same problem area. And that the turn of the wheel, the turn of the cycle of ages has come full round, and we're back at that crisis point again. Where the Greeks could not extend beyond the city, and classical antiquity never did, the ultimate metaphor for the city was Alexandria. I mean, when the Athenian Greeks couldn't do it, the Macedonian tough boys in the far north, using the great teachings of Aristotle, who was the cream intellect from Athens, fled from Athens, was driven out of Athens. They said, we don't want to have idea boys around here, especially people like you. You remind us too much of the suffering, that we can't cut it. And Aristotle becoming the private tutor of the young Alexander the Great, and Alexander getting the idea that there must be some way, instead of having a city that's based on tribes and clans, let's have a city based on all of the ethnic types of humanity. Maybe that kind of a city would work. And it was a brave attempt. It was a fantastic attempt to make a world city based on all the kinds of men. But the whole limitation is that the city is not able to carry that energy of life on that level. It's not an adequate form. Man has long since learned to deal with cities. Even little places like Concord, Massachusetts, when it has a conscious population, can produce a renaissance. Little place like Florence can produce a renaissance. Man has mastered cities, but he has never mastered those socio-political forms beyond. The nation-state is an imitation of the Roman Empire, and the nation-state has been bankrupt as an idea for a long, long time. The best idea was the United States, which is a nation-state made specifically to experiment with forms, to come up with some form that would work. And that's been the best in history so far, the United States as a form of allowing for the experimentation among its own people to find a form that will work for them. And as Jefferson said, we may have to dissolve it every generation, every 19 years. And we should have the right to do this because we're trying to find a form that will work. We don't know a form that will work. But we do know that we have capacities in us to bring out the elements of a new form that will work. I don't want to get off on the digressions, but I want to point out to you how protean the material is that we're dealing with. So that the problem, in a symbolic way, became the problem of going back to the initiation structure in the first place. The initiation structure of how one moves from ritual through the mythic expression of what that ritual means to the integration of it in a symbolic sense within. The Greek word for the ritual comportment, pompei, which we get, pompous from, or pompei is the flourish of activity. The agon, the agony, the struggle, and then the komos, the final quality of everything that finally turns out. One comes into a new maturity. Komos gets watered down into a sense of comedy later on, where the epitome is a marriage. Most comedies, classical comedies, would end with some kind of a marriage thing. What it means is that one has a new form of oneself so that you are not jeopardized by merging with another person into a new form. The couple as a new person, a new form of the person. None of this should be identified with just the literal interpretation of the content, but to see that this is a symbolic structure. You have a new deep self which is able to marry the new expressive form of your person, and thus the life energy which you are capable of is able to flow through that new form, where the deep self and the person are in sync. So it's like the individual has an inner marriage. Notice that it's not an inner reconciliation of opposites per se, but it's an inner reconciliation of a new capacity of integration with a new expression of that integration in life. To say that it's a reconciliation of opposites is to mistake metaphor for actuality. Unfortunately, a lot of psychology has gone that way. Helen Foley has taken a lot of her work, a lot of her thinking from this book, Aeschylus in Athens. This is a reprint. It's been out for a long time by George Thompson. And in Thompson's book, even the reprint here is not too bad, he has a page which has an outline of the history of initiation in terms of Greek sociological structures, which is extremely interesting to see. And one can see that at the top left, I'll make copies during the break for you, that tragedy is one of the most sophisticated of all initiation techniques, but that it has no successor. That whole line of development comes to a dead end with tragedy. And it's important to understand that lineage of initiation stops there. That the whole horizon of human capacity to deal with the self-learning quality transcends entirely this realm of possibility. Self-learning. This entire range of initiation, through all of its permutations, has the prejudice, if I can use that term, I want to use something derisive. It has the prejudice that someone else will initiate you. Your parents will initiate you. The elders in the community will initiate you. The priests will initiate you. Whereas at this level of sophistication, when one gets to the tragic view of life, further participation in any effective initiation must be self-generated and not other-generated, no matter who the other is. No matter how much respect one has for the other, the form no longer works. The Greeks never came up with self-initiation. Never. It broke their psychological backs. It took an interpenetration of Egyptian and Jewish and Greek and other cultures feeding in to make this new dimension of self-initiation a possibility. And you can see how this is an extraordinary kind of equality. Now, in terms of world history, the first person to ever self-initiate himself was the historical Buddha. The first evidence that we have of anyone who was ever able to self-initiate himself. And sometime, maybe next year in the 1990s, if I get time, I'll try and go through to take off all of the historical accretions from Buddhism and just present, maybe in 3 months or something, the basic primordial Buddhism, which is extraordinary story. Extraordinary story, showing that there is a method, but the method which the Buddha used was to analytically peel off everything that did not work. But the overall context in which he did this peeling off was within an expanded form of North Indian initiation. The initiation which centers around bringing the meditative self to a tree, to a pole, to some sort of a center. Only in the classical Buddhism it isn't just the Bodhi tree, but there are four trees. And it's the cycle of showing that the four trees together have another center, which is not a tree, which is not an identifiable self that comes out of any of the four trees, but is some mysterious fifth, a fifth essence, a quintessence, which doesn't have a place where it came from in nature. And yet it is, and therefore it must have been prior to all nature. The mysterious center, the non-self. And of course this, at the time of the Buddha, was just, it was almost impossible for anyone to appreciate except in this kind of charismatic, magnetic way of someone in personal contact with the Buddha having him give them that interpersonal capacity space by physical psychic contact, if you wish. And for a long time, the tradition went on in terms of people contacting people who had contacted people who had contacted the Buddha and so forth. And one of the great powers in Jesus' teaching is to get rid of the whole necessity for that magnetic chain of contact, to be able to do it yourself, to have that self-initiation capacity anywhere at any time, even if you don't have a teacher, even if you don't have a lineage, to in other words, make self-initiation a portable, mobile, omniscient capacity at any time. I don't want to get into it too much, but I want to bring this out because, and then we'll take our our break. George Thompson, in his book on Aeschylus and Athens, now notice, the city and the artist. He writes in here, quoting a wonderful Neopythagorean mathematician, Theon of Smyrna. Theon of Smyrna was the father of the great Alexandrian teacher Hypatia, one of the great women of history. He quotes, "On the successive grades of initiation in the Eleusinian mysteries, as described by Theon of Smyrna," and here's Theon telling us, 800 years after Euripides. "The parts of initiation are five." In other words, in the Eleusinian mysteries, there's a five phase, as one would expect, initiation. Notice now that there's a particular quality to it. It can be five phases, but as Thompson will point out, there are only three phases really. There's something about the fourth and the fifth phase that are mysterious indeed. Here's Theon. "The parts of initiation are five. The first is purification. The mysteries are not open to all who wish to partake of them, some being warned to keep away, such as those who have unclean hands or unintelligible speech. And even those who are not debarred must first receive purification. Next, after purification, is the administration of the rite, R-I-T-E. The actual administration, going through the rite, the ritual, the second phase. Purification, the ritual. The third phase is the so-called epopteia, E-P-O-P-T-E-I-A, with the emphasis on the I, so you have three vowels at the end. Epopteia. That's the third phase. The fourth, which is also the end of the epopteia, is the crowning and laying on of the garland. It's not only the laying on of the garland like a Hawaiian hostess greeting you off the plane. It's like laying on of the hands in a floral wreath, very much like the imagery like the world card in the tarot deck in the Major Arcana. The world card in the Major Arcana of the tarot deck is this Eleusinian mystery of laying the garland of it all onto you. And notice that in the world card, in the Waite-Smith deck, that person who steps through is naked to it all, does not have any identifiable angle of origin or expression. It can be a naked man or a woman in the cards, because of the Victorian slants, a naked woman. In the weight deck, what it means symbolically is that the person has symbolically no clothes, no need of clothes. There's no sociological identification that has anything to do with such a person. That person is free of all. Not only is an integration of all the possibilities, but is even beyond that, is freed from this world. Hence, the garland presenting that is the world. So that the fourth, which is also the end of the epopteia, is the crowning, a wreath on the head, and the laying on of the garland, which empowers him after becoming a hierophantes, or a diduchos, or other official, to administer the rite to others. In other words, one becomes a hierophant, capable of passing this on to others. And the fifth and the last is the blessedness which comes of enjoying the love of the gods and feasting with the gods. Now this this fifth is very mysterious. The classical Greek phrase for such a one in that quintessential state, it isn't just enjoying blessedness, unless you think of blessedness with a capital B. The phrase is that one becomes a guardian spirit. The Greek phrase, a daimones epimeleis, E-P-I-M-E-L-E-I-S, a guardian spirit. In other words, you no longer have to participate in the struggle, but you can appreciate the struggle of others, and so you become a helper for others. Thompson gives us this, and then we'll take a break. The writer, Theon of Smyrna, he is concerned to show that there are five grades because that number is necessary to his argument. But as he admits himself, the third and the fourth are really one. And in other writers, the initial purification is not counted as a grade of initiation at all, but regarded as preliminary. The five grades of Theon may therefore be reduced to three. The first is miesis, or initiation, M-Y-E-S-I-S, with the accent on the Y. Miesis, or initiation, epopteia, and the spiritual bliss, eudaimonia. Now, the middle rank, the rank of epoptes, was attained, as we have seen, in the second year after initiation. There are actually two initiations separated by a full year. The lesser mysteries, and then a full year, and a little bit more, and then the greater mysteries. The initiation into the lesser mysteries is really the culmination of the purification. The lesser mysteries means that you've been purified. What does it mean? Psychologically, it means that you are now ready to receive. What are you ready to receive? You are ready to receive a new integration. You've been opened up. The Greek term for this, of laying the new power into that opening, was epiklesis. It's a part of a religious ritual. Still, the original high Christian church in the Greek Orthodox tradition still has this whole moment, especially if, and you don't have to be a Christian particularly to go and appreciate this, if you go to a Greek Orthodox Christmas ceremony, and the Greek Orthodox, the center of the whole motion focuses around that if you are now ready, we are now acting as a conduit, as a prism, to bring in divine power. And if you are open to receive it, now is the time that you will receive it. And it doesn't have anything to do with doctrine. It doesn't have anything to do, in fact, with codes of religious belief. It's a human psychic capacity that if you are open, someone working in an integrated way, can I use the term, dare I use the term, channels the energy. It is the energy which is real. It isn't a function that these channelers are great or that you are great, but that the energy actually does occur in this form. It is able to be passed through someone intact and to enter into an openness fully. And the realization is that in ancient times, this was the nature of God. God is is that who passes through our wholeness intact and achieves manifest, definite wholeness in another. I don't know if I'm making it strong enough here. It's like if Jerry is the vehicle by which this energy is channeled, and I am the initiate, the receptor, if I'm open, God is able to pass intact through the wholeness of Jerry and come whole here in my openness. There is nothing in me natural generated that would be able to do that. There's nothing in Jerry natural generated that would be able to do that. There's nothing in nature that would be able to do that. No matter how we understand that, that is a supernatural happening. Because by all standards, there should be something in Jerry which takes something, is a resistance for that energy in some way or other, and there should be something in me that is just unable to receive. Even if I were just psychically genius at being open and physically disciplined at being physically open, wouldn't achieve 100%. I could get close with discipline, get above 95%, but to get 100%, you see, is not possible in nature. It's not possible to do that. But that it does in fact happen is like the discovery that that the supernatural, so-called, is real. That the 100% actually does occur. There are all sorts of ways to express this in religions. The basic thing is that in the initiation and the maiesis is the preparation. All initiation is the preparation for this. The agon in the preparation is getting rid of the old sense of self, getting rid of the old mask, of the old limitations, and not replacing it by a new mask or a new limitation. Instead, one can displace an old mask by a new mask, an old role by a new role. But the knack here, and I'm not using it derisively, the technical knack here is to take the old away and keep oneself open, not put a new in at all, so that the newness is openness and not another mask, not another role. So that the purification becomes perfected when that occurs, when you're able to be, as Wallace Stevens said, a man with no face, no particular face. Then comes the epopteia. And that this was attained, as we have seen, writes Thompson, in the second year after initiation in the Little Mysteries. The word epoptes means both an onlooker and a supervisor. It's the ancient Greek way of describing being aware of awareness. That which is aware of awareness, that which is conscious of consciousness, self-consciousness, self-awareness. An onlooker and a supervisor. As an onlooker, the epoptes was permitted to hold the secret rites enacted in the hall of initiation. As a supervisor, he administered those rites to others. Now, the same word was used at Olympia to denote a steward or supervisor of the Olympic Games originally. That is, in its original Homeric religious realization, those who supervised the Olympic Games were epoptes. We've come a long way and no longer understand athletics, can you understand that the athlete is the perfection, the purification, not only of the body, but of the inner person? So that originally, the same word was also used at Olympia to denote a steward or supervisor at the games. There is no need to suppose that the Eleusinian use of this term was derived particularly from Olympia any more than the Olympian from Eleusis, because both have now been traced independently to their common origin in the primitive ritual of initiation. At both places, the epoptai were, or had been, like the Choretes of the Cretan myth, the men who, having been initiated themselves, superintended the initiation of others. At Olympia, the ordeal of initiation was a race. At Eleusis, it became a passion play in which the crisis of change was projected as a terrifying drama of the soul on its journey through death to salvation. That the Greeks themselves were conscious of the significance underlying the double application of the term epoptes is clear from various passages in antiquity. The one that Thompson uses here is from Plutarch, and Plutarch is a first century AD master of the Greek mysteries, knew what he was talking about. And then he points out that the use of the same form and the same technique appears in the New Testament of the Bible in the esoteric writing of the Epistle to the Hebrews. The cloud of witnesses in that document are the epoptai. So there are all kinds of ins and outs to this. Now we're going to take a break in just a minute. Let's sum this up as best we can. The old capacity had come into personal use or into sociologically designated communal use of a certain integration of capacities of ritual, myth, and symbols. They had been brought together. And they had been held together. Those three had been held together by the psychic energy which was generated by the activity of these three together. So that if one wanted to have like a diagram of what you were the ritual, myth, symbol, magic capacity together as a whole. But when that psychic energy began to function all of its own, it realized, psychic energy realizes, that it has displaced nature in the wholeness of the primordial being. The original shape, the original quaternary, was nature, ritual, myth, and symbol. But when psychic energy, which naturally comes out of this, begins to generate, it displaces nature, and magic displaces nature in the functioning of the person. Notice how there is an unease then between magic and nature on the psychic energy level. Notice how Dionysus rejects this, says that nature cannot be displaced with impunity, and that a man who does this, man or woman who does this, will have to be brought back down to earth. Nature will win out over this magic of psychic energy of consciousness. Notice that the way in which nature has a hold on such a psychic quaternary, it doesn't have a hold through myth. It doesn't have a hold through symbols. It does not have a hold through magic. Its only access is through ritual. Nature's only handle on such a person is the ritual level. So that the psyche made up of ritual, myth, symbol, and magic is not stable. We would say in physics today it's an isotope. It's an unstable isotope. Nature, ritual, myth, and symbol is very stable, but of its own stability generates this quintessential, this fifth essence, this hermetic magical quality of psychic energy. One has to really be anesthetized to not have psychic energy come out of this. One becomes powered. One becomes energized. And the more one becomes energized, the less nature has as a whole. And the more, in the Dionysiac myth, the more nature then wants to get the hold back through ritual. So that one has to transform the ritual into a new dimension. So that not only will nature be transformed into magic, but ritual will be transformed into art. And myth and symbol and magic and art is pretty stable. Myth and symbol and magic and art are as stable as the natural quaternary. We won't get to the sociological problems of the extra individual, beyond the individual. That is problem enough. What is beyond the individual? You can achieve stability in yourself. You can follow a rigorous disciplinary program. There, I could give you 70 different kinds of discipline myself that you could become stable as a person in and of yourself. But the problem is that there are other people. The problem is eventually history. It is a real problem. What is the saying? You and I are together, but what about them? And come to think of it, I'm not so sure about you. It's that kind of a problem which we'll have to eventually see. But for now, the conception is that when magic displaces nature, when psychic energy displaces the natural, the ritual comportment has to be refined into art. And instead of the ritual engendering images, art has to engender this symbolic comprehension. Art deals with wholes, wholenesses. Whereas the image base deals with the one-to-one correlations. But nature can yank you back through those one-to-one correlations on the ritual level, can play with your images, unless those images are integrated on the personal artistic level. And that integration on the personal artistic level works the psychic energy into the very forms. The very forms of artistic activity have worked into them one psychic energy, so that one psychic energy is no longer jeopardized by a compensatory, quote, blind nature, naturalness, saying, oh, that magic's got to go. We can't have that. We want the good, clean, plain wholeness from before. But the fact is that the conditions have changed. One can't be that anymore. When you're a child, you can. When you mature, you can't. So that the material, you can see, all centers around this achievement in art of a new person, the art of person making. The whole problem centers around this. The golden thread in that problem is your ability to use language in a new way. Not to use language in a mythic way where the images are the rollers that give it mobility, but in a new way where it is the personal designation of meaning in terms of your own personal integration. Magical language, as we're calling it here, instead of mythic language. Notice that myths are still there. Myths will have their turn. When will myths be phased out of the wholeness? When history comes in. History jeopardizes mythology. And you can see that one of the sophisticated New Age thinkers of our time, Joseph Campbell, opts for the choice of regressing back and keeping myth and junking history. Let's keep the myth, the symbols, the magic, and the art. Let's follow our own bliss. Ah, but the problem with history won't go away. The terror of history, as Eliade says, is a nightmare which is constantly there in the mind of man now. It's never going to go away. It has the same eerie quality as that woman who was abducted by the aliens in the UFO said. She doesn't have to think about it. Every night when she goes to bed and every morning when she wakes up, it's there, the realization that this happened. Once one has been in history, you can't erase it. You can't get rid of it. And you can't go fleeing back into mythologies and think you're going to be safe, because the terror of history brings its compensatory demonicness now with it and leeches out the significance of myth, leaving it hollow, so that one ends up no longer with the stable quaternary that once was, but one ends up with the moth-eaten wretchedness. Yes, you have your art and your magic and your symbols, and your moth-eaten mythology, which in the book of Daniel is described as having feet of clay. You have the head of gold, and you have the body of silver, and you have the thighs of brass, and you have the feet of clay. It will not stand. That person cannot stand. And so, the problem in a nutshell for such a person who is regressing back into mythology, hoping that that's going to be the stability that it once was, the problem is the future. The future, with quotation marks, becomes a real nightmare. Anything to do with the future is the personification of history, of the terror of history, as a threat. And it become, and the 20th century, in a sociological way, is just one single long nightmare of human beings trying. What James Joyce said, history is a nightmare I'm trying to wake up from. But the fact is that we don't wake up from it. The whole fact that that occurs with the feeling tone of a nightmare is a structural problem with the maturation of the psyche in the first place. There's a whole series of realizations around this. Now, with these numbers, let me explain this once more. You did haiku about 3 weeks ago, a month ago, and we made up those brochures for you, those pamphlets, collected those haiku together, and you have them. I now have a second collection of haiku, which during the break I'm going to use scissors and paste and put together and make a second pamphlet. This second pamphlet will be different from the first pamphlet. The first pamphlet is your attempt in a naive way, in a kind of a natural way, to write haiku. The second pamphlet are haiku that come out of experience with this, out of the psychic energy, out of the magic level of dealing with this. The first group is a way to try and shape language symbolically on your own. And the resources that you would have had in terms of a structural analysis, you would have had a mythic capacity integrated by your symbolic acumen. The second group, you're working with the symbolic capacity structured by your psychic acumen. How good can I work with this language? The third group, which you're going to do during the break, steps up one more ratchet and works with the psychic capacity with an artistic acumen. So the three different groups of haiku should disclose this arrangement, this tertiary arrangement. The first group working from a mythic level for a symbolic integration, the second group working from a symbolic level for a psychic or magic integration, and the third working from the psychic or magical level for an artistic integration. And if it works at all, it will work. If it does at all, it will work.